It is Monday, March the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Syrian government forces or the rebels in charge in eastern Ghouta.
There's no doubt that government forces are going to be in command of the ground in a pure military sense.
Also ahead is a trade war on the horizon for the U.S. and the rest of the world.
I think there's a serious danger of a trade war here. These steps are outside of the bounds of sort of normal trade action.
Also ahead, social media and the sounds of Britain's Paul Young. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad vows to continue an offensive in eastern Ghouta. That's near Damascus as his forces advance in the last major rebel enclave near the capital. He said, "We will continue to fight terrorism. We will do. We'll start now at Ghouta. We'll start fighting one more terrorism." He started in Aleppo and Homs, he said, in Deir ez-Zor. The operation in Ghouta, he says, is a continuation of the fight against terrorism in all different areas. Assad also said he believes the people of eastern Ghouta want a return to state rule. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Middle East scholar Ambassador David Mack for his thoughts on Assad's comments.
I think this is vintage Bashar al-Assad claiming that he's fighting terrorism on behalf of all the Syrian people, including the population of eastern Ghouta and other areas east of Damascus, who have been holding out for years now against the domination of the regime. I've no doubt that there are some Syrian civilians who, out of sheer desperation and with the starvation tactics and so on, might prefer to make their peace with the Bashar al-Assad regime. But in fact, if they're doing it, that is under sheer duress. The evidence is that they are retreating farther east along with the various fighters, who include a substantial number of people that I think we would consider as terrorists, along with others who simply have been fighting for independence and to protect the civilians with whom they are related and neighbors and so on.
The United States made one of its strongest statements yet on Moscow's complicity in the civilian deaths in eastern Ghouta region. Russia has gone on to ignore a UN ceasefire and to kill innocent civilians under the false auspices of counterterrorism operations. Now, they've been tracking Russian warplanes, but they cannot prove those planes carried ordnance that dropped on eastern Ghouta.
Whether or not those planes were engaged, along with the Syrian Air Force, in dropping high-explosive munitions and barrel bombs on the civilian population, the plain fact is that the Russians have not evidently exercised any serious degree of control over the Syrian regime and the Syrian military. They may even be operating with them, but even if they're not operating with them, I think that they are guilty of complicity because they obviously have the capability of cutting the Syrian Air Force off. It seems to me that if they may have started out with some kind of scheme for humanitarian relief corridors that was half serious, they have basically backed down from any serious humanitarian efforts in the face of the obstinacy of the Assad regime. It's quite clear that Bashar intends to subdue this area by a combination of attacks from the air and sending in armed groups that may or may not include Syrian regular military, but would certainly include militias that are allied with him. And the Russians are simply not making an effort to restrain him.
One of the main insurgent groups in eastern Ghouta, Jaish al-Islam, said the government's, quote, scorched earth policy forced rebels to retreat and regroup, but vowed to recover lost territory. I believe we've spoken before saying the trajectory seems to favor government forces.
Oh, I think there's no doubt that government forces are going to be in command of the ground in a pure military sense. I think it's, on the other hand, extraordinarily unlikely that any time in the foreseeable future the Syrians in these areas will accept the indefinite rule of the Bashar al-Assad regime, although certainly under conditions of desperation, they may acquiesce in it.
Do you see any effort to pull back this offensive, or is Russia and Iran, its ally, going to back this offensive?
I don't see any serious international efforts to do this, despite the calls of the United States and the United Kingdom, the United Nations officials as well. I think, along with the evidence of the weakness of the Western position in bringing any meaningful pressure to bear, is that the French have asked the Iranians to exercise some kind of restraint on Bashar al-Assad. I think that's even less likely than the Russians doing it.
And you see this as a failure of international diplomacy?
I'm afraid we would have to count it a failure of international diplomacy and an evidence of the continuing weakness of Washington in countering Russian and Syrian regime strategy.
David Mack is former Deputy Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and the American Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He's now a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Ambassador Mack was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. A top trade advisor to President Trump says a process will be in place for businesses to get exemptions from the White House plan to place steep tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, offering the first indication a tariff hike could be less broad than first thought. Peter Navarro is the director of the White House National Trade Council.
We have the lowest tariffs in the world. We have the lowest non-tariff barriers. We are the free tradingest nation of the world. And what do we get for that? We don't get fair and reciprocal trade. We get every year a $500 billion trade deficit that transfers our wealth to other countries and basically offshores our jobs and our factories.
Navarro also said countries will not be excluded from the tariffs because that would become a slippery slope. But there will be a mechanism, he says, for corporate exemptions in some cases. VOA's Ira Melman speaks with Phil Levy, a senior fellow on the global economy with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, about whether a trade war is coming.
I think there's a serious danger of a trade war here. These steps are outside of the bounds of sort of normal trade actions. We have major trading partners who have threatened responses, and the president's reaction has been, then he will escalate. That certainly has all the makings of a trade war.
What would it take to escalate into a trade war? You said retaliatory action either on probably on both sides, right?
That's right. So I think there's no precise definition of what makes for a trade war. I think the rule of thumb one can use is when you start getting uncontrolled spirals of retaliation. So the whole trading system is set up so that if one country does something bad, then another country can file a complaint, get the right to retaliate. They retaliate once, but that's it. This is like, you know, your brother punches you, you get one punch back, you're done. It's when things start spiraling out of control and everybody escalates that you get closer to what we think of as a trade war.
The president tweeted on Saturday that the United States has an $800 billion yearly trade deficit because of our very stupid trade deals and policies, and said our jobs and wealth are being given to other countries that have taken advantage of us for years. They laugh at what fools our leaders have been no more. What's your reaction?
I think he's got all that exactly backwards, including when they're doing the laughing at the leaders, which I think may be happening now much more than it did before. I think the president has long been fixated on the trade deficit, and he's failed to understand it. The U.S. trade deficit is not a reflection of trade policies. It's a reflection of the fact that we borrow a great deal from the rest of the world. If you are going to borrow from the rest of the world as a country, then you are going to run a trade deficit. And if anything, this president has worked to escalate our borrowing from the rest of the world with a tax bill that had a $1.5 trillion price tag attached.
Draw me up a little scenario of what happens if these tariffs are put into place.
I think if these tariffs are put into place, you get an immediate effect, which is that it is raising the price to some domestic producers. Now, to be fair, since there was some warning, this has been in the works for about a year, some domestic producers may have stockpiled a bit, so it wouldn't necessarily be an immediate hit, but it will eventually be a hit. You know, as you will note, very, very few of us actually consume aluminum or steel as individuals. These are inputs into other products. And so this is an increase in costs, which will either cut into, you know, corporate well-being, undoing the benefits of the tax cut, or it will get passed along to consumers, and that will raise prices. Raising prices, that is probably going to prompt the Fed to act more quickly to raise interest rates and try and slow the economy down and head off inflation. Meanwhile, you have other countries whose imports have been blocked where they see violations of global trading rules saying that they're not going to sit down and take it. We've already heard that from Europe. We've heard that from Canada. And they will start to selectively attack key American exports.
That's Phil Levy. He is a senior fellow on global economy with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
Absolutely. Time now for a look at what's happening on social media. VOA's Lori London here with what's happening. What you got there, Lori?
Well, Steve, on Hollywood's biggest night, the Oscars, in a year of the Me Too and Time's Up movements, the internet is really buzzing now over American Idol and Live with Kelly and Ryan star Ryan Seacrest, who just happens to be the latest celebrity accused of sexual misconduct. But despite those allegations and how dominant the topic is on the show this year, his employer, E! News, decided to allow him to go forward with hosting red carpet events at Sunday night's Oscars ceremonies. Now, the founder of the hashtag MeToo movement, Tarana Burke, told Variety that the decision put female celebrities in a difficult position as they entered the Dolby Theater for the ceremony and were expected to be interviewed by Seacrest. She also said that at a time when people are really paying attention to what women have been saying for decades, women shouldn't have to make that choice of whether or not to avoid Seacrest. He has been accused by a former stylist who claims she lost her job after reporting him for sexual misconduct and assault. After hashtag founder Tarana Burke's comments, Seacrest started trending on Twitter. It did appear as if some A-list celebrities did avoid him on the red carpet, but it wasn't that noticeable. It was more noticeable on Twitter. And while many users made comments that they were perplexed that he was allowed to continue hosting on the red carpet, there were others who defended him, saying that at this point it's just accusations. One person even went so far as to say, quote, "I can't speak to the allegations against him, but I do know there are 12 children's hospitals who have benefited greatly from the Ryan Seacrest Foundation." And now moving on to another major social media story that's really warming a lot of hearts. The internet is going crazy over a photo of a little African-American girl at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. She was staring at the brand new portrait of former First Lady Michelle Obama, and despite her mother encouraging her to turn around for a photo, the little girl was just in awe and wouldn't stop staring. The photo, then, of her staring was snapped by another museum visitor, Ben Hines of North Carolina. He took a quick photo of the little girl, posted it on Facebook, and guess what? It went viral. He tells BuzzFeed News he was just so touched and uplifted by the beautiful child looking at this beautiful portrait of a powerful woman. Now, the little girl is 2-year-old Parker Curry, and her mother took Parker and her 1-year-old sister to the museum to see the portraits of Barack and Michelle Obama and just couldn't get the child to turn around for the photo. She just was so mesmerized by the portrait. Now, the girl's mom told BuzzFeed, "In the world we live in today, I'm just trying to raise a little girl who has opportunities to see women who look like her doing great things." So, a little moment that seems to really have brought on a big message. Now, Ben's initial post, by the way, has been shared thousands of times on Facebook and has now also been posted and trending on Instagram and Twitter. One person on Twitter noting, "Talk about a picture being worth a thousand words." Steve?
And many thanks to you, Lori, VOA's Lori London. Well, I think most of you would agree that orchids are among the world's most beautiful flowers. And although the blossoms come in different shapes, sizes, colors, we all know that they belong to one of the largest and oldest families of flowering plants here on Earth. The U.S. Botanic Garden here in Washington is showcasing some of those thousands of different orchid varieties. And VOA's Deborah Block takes us there.
The exquisite orchid comes in almost every color of the rainbow, from orchid habitats to the conservation of rare and endangered orchids. Visitors who come to the exhibit at the U.S. Botanic Garden in Washington enjoy the dazzling array of displays.
It's just beautiful. I mean, it's really awesome.
I've never seen anything like it, and I'm glad I'm here to see it all.
There are 25,000 varieties of orchids around the world, ranging from yellow and orange to pink and purple and more, says Devin Dotson, a spokesman for the National Garden.
But it's really difficult to find orchids in almost any flower in actual blue forms. And this is a species found in the Philippines that naturally has blue tones.
Remarkably, orchids are found on every continent except Antarctica, and can survive both extremely hot and cold temperatures.
Orchids are masters at adapting to different environments. Even here in the United States, they exist in bogs. Bogs are places where it stays wet almost all of the time. These are growing in the soil. Well, maybe in other tropical places and rainforest and things, orchids aren't found in the soil.
Some orchids attach themselves to other plants and trees.
They've adapted over time to live up high in the tropics or the canopy of trees, and they have exposed roots, but they're covered with this white velamen. And it's a substance that helps attract the nutrients and moisture and feed the roots through the air, so they don't need soil.
The shapes and sizes of the plants vary greatly. They can range from a tiny 2 millimeters to a huge 90 kilograms. Some orchids have tall spikes, while others are a cluster of flowers. The blooms of certain plants last only a few hours, while others remain for 6 months. The most brightly colored blossoms come from tropical regions.
There's hot spots in a lot of the tropical areas, from Latin America to some of the Asian countries. In fact, they're so popular that certain countries celebrate them as their national flower.
Many of the most popular orchids today are cross-pollinated hybrids.
The first orchid hybrids were created in England in the 1850s. And at this point, there's more than 110,000 orchid hybrids that have been created. There's about 3,000 new orchid hybrids created every year.
While they are known primarily for their beauty, orchids are also used in perfume and as medicine in parts of Asia and the Middle East. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Paul Young. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists who studied a hot Jupiter-like exoplanet with NASA's Hubble and Spitzer Space Telescopes were able to detect signs of water in its atmosphere. And they didn't just find signs of some water, but a lot of water. Three times the amount of water on our solar system's own Jupiter. The exoplanet they studied is known as WASP-39b, located about 700 light-years from Earth. The detected atmospheric water of WASP-39b is said to be in vapor form. Although the exoplanet is now eight times closer to its host star than Mercury is to the Sun, the researchers say that because of the amount of water spotted, WASP-39b probably first developed far away from its star, where it was blasted by a great deal of icy material. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music.
Young
Young is a singer-songwriter from Britain, formerly frontman of several bands that didn't last too long, including Cat Cool and the Cool Cats, Street Band, and the Q-Tips, and became a 1980s teen idol as well with songs like Oh Girl. But even the crowd can't help me now. Young is famous for his hit singles such as Oh Girl, and of course, Every Time You Go Away. In 1982, Young formed a group, Los Pacaminos, based on the sounds of Ry Cooder's Chicken Skin music era and the Tex-Mex group, the Texas Tornadoes. They first performed low-key events in bars and clubs before progressing onto theaters. And in 1996, Paul Young was again outperforming solos and preparing for his next album. Is still out on the road performing a mix of songs with Love always on the playlist. It's an interpretation of the Al Green classic that has Paul Young returning to the soulful sound that originally gave him worldwide fame.
Baby, I started to write this song about you. Then I decided that I would write it all about love. And it appeared to me that you wasn't happy, and that's for sure, positively. that's what the world is made of. So give me more of that love. Love is a walk down Main Street. Love is an apple that is so sweet. Love is something that can't be beaten.
Yeah, he's got it right. Love is hard to beat. Yes, indeedy. Hey, listen, we love you, and we thank you for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Guess what? The latest world news is up next. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Paul Young.
Love is a story that just can't be told. Can't you feel it burning? More and more. Stop and look at the big wheel roll. I can't explain this feeling. Can't you see salvation is free? I would give my life for the glory just to be able to tell this story about love. Such a happy feel about love. Love is something that is so divine. Love's a feeling that's a friend of mine. Can't be measured by no sign. I send love in your heart and even in your mind. Love is a walk down Main Street. Love is an apple that is so sweet. Something can't be beaten. L-O-V-E is strange to me.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Department of State has designated Ansarul Islam as a specially designated global terrorist. This designation imposes strict sanctions on foreign individuals determined to have committed or pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism that threaten the security of Americans or the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States. This designation seeks to deny Ansarul Islam the resources it needs to plan and carry out further terrorist attacks. Among other consequences, all of its property and interests in property subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and Americans are generally prohibited from engaging in any transactions with the group. Ansarul Islam is a terrorist group based in the West African nation of Burkina Faso. The group has launched numerous attacks in northern Burkina Faso near the border with Mali, including a December 2016 attack against an army squad that killed a dozen soldiers, one of the deadliest ever attacks against Burkina Faso's military. Ansarul Islam also carried out a February 2017 strike on two police stations in the country and is believed to be responsible for the March 2017 murder of a school director and another man in Courfeyrac, Burkina Faso. This terrorist designation notifies the U.S. public and the international community that Ansarul Islam has committed or poses a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Terrorism designations expose and isolate organizations and individuals and deny them access to the U.S. financial system. Moreover, designations can assist the law enforcement activities of U.S. agencies and other governments. The United States remains committed to rooting out all terrorist groups, including Ansarul Islam, wherever they may lurk.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
from Washington.